The following program was pre-recorded. On WFAN, it's time for Hello, My Name is Craig, our weekly candid conversation about gambling addiction. It's supported by the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey, 800-GAMBLER. Now, here's Craig Carton.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Hello, My Name is Craig. Craig Carton with you. Great to have you here as we start enjoying the Memorial Day weekend. And that means we're still in May, of course, and it's Mental Health Awareness Month. So I thought we would take a bit of a detour around what we normally do on the show, which is exclusively gambling addiction, and spend some time on mental health, and gambling addiction is certainly a part of that. And I want to introduce the audience to Matthew Bocci, who wrote a book called Sway. Matt, good morning. How you doing, pal?
Doing well. Good morning, Craig. Honored to be here.
Thanks for joining us. I'm enthralled with your story on an emotional level, because Matthew wrote a book about his life. And his life, or at least from a book standpoint, began on the morning of 9/11. And we're a couple months away from the 20th anniversary, of course, of the terrible attacks. And here we are in May, Mental Health Awareness Month, and Matt lost his dad on 9/11. And from that moment on, over the course of what seems like a solid decade, Matt went down a really bad rabbit hole. Gambling was part of it, but not the only part of it. Drugs, sexual abuse, and a number of other things that I have a specific correlation to in my life. So I thought it was important for Matt to be able to tell his story. So I appreciate your willingness to join us to go through what I'm sure is a very tough thing to go through. So thank you for that.
Of course, of course.
So, the only way to start is, I suppose, on 9/11. And if you don't mind walking people through your experience on that morning when you found out, or you started to find out, that your dad was in the towers. If you don't mind walking people through that moment, I'd appreciate that.
Sure. So, as many remember from that day, it was a beautiful September morning, crystal clear blue sky day. And I was starting fourth grade. And at about a little bit after 9 o'clock in the morning, they pulled me and another kid out of the class, and they informed us that a plane hit our dad's building. We were then met in the hallway by both of our younger brothers, who were in second grade at the time. And so they took the four of us and they brought us into another room. They told us that the plane hit the building, they were evacuating the tower, and that both of our dads were safe. Those other students, their dad was safe. He was on a lower floor. Unfortunately for my brother and I and my other brothers, our dad was on the 105th floor of the North Tower at Cantor Fitzgerald. So unbeknownst to me at that time, right after the plane hit, about 3 minutes after, actually, my dad phoned my mom and told her that a plane hit the building. And my dad, being the prankster that he was, she automatically assumed he was joking. She quickly turned the TV on. The line got cut out and she saw what was going on in lower Manhattan. And, starts calling him back and forth. They're calling each other, both getting connected to one another, but can't hear each other. They're just constant static on the line. And then finally, he gets through to her one last time and ultimately says goodbye and that he loves her. And all of this was obviously unknown to me in that moment. And my mom did what she chose was the smarter move, and I definitely agree. And she kept my brother and I in school. All the kids in my school, and it was a small school, were getting pulled out one by one. Parents were coming in crying hysterically, not knowing what was going on. Obviously everyone was freaking out. And at the end of the day, my brother Nick and I get on the bus, and we're the only ones on the bus pretty much. We get back home. And I should rewind, actually. My uncle Tony, my dad's brother, was the last person who spoke to my dad, and he saw what was going on and started calling my dad as well. And this was right after my mom spoke to him. And my dad picked up the phone after my uncle had probably tried calling him 50 plus times in a couple minute span. And my dad picked up the phone as if it was a normal day. My uncle was interning at that time. He was just about to start law school, and he was interning in Manhattan. And they used to grab lunch together all the time. My dad picked it up and he just said, hello. Very calm, didn't sound scared, and exhibited the type of bravery that he really showed as a man, and courage. And he didn't show any fear or anything in that moment. And my uncle said, you know, John, get out. And he just said, Tony, I love you. And to me, he pretty much accepted his fate, I believe, in that moment.
So he was saying goodbye.
He was saying goodbye. Yeah.
Got it. So you're in fourth grade. So you're what, 12 years old? You're nine years old. You have younger brothers. You know, at the moment, you don't know what's going on, but we all obviously kind of have a sense of what's going on. Your mom is starting to understand the gravity of what's going on. You get home. I know there's a lot of family and neighbors are now coming in and out of the house, frantic, as many families we're dealing with out in Long Island, and you're throughout the five boroughs in Westchester, Connecticut, et cetera. Cantor Fitzgerald, the hardest hit of any company on this planet for 9/11. How long after that moment did you guys get the information that your dad had not survived the attacks?
Well, it was becoming pretty clear by the end of the day that, you know, that he wasn't going to come home. But we held on to that hope, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
3 days later, September 14th, that Friday, they found him. And they came to our house exactly a week after 9/11 to tell us that they found him. So it was, for us, we were very lucky and honestly grateful in some ways that we had those answers. You know, many people still to this day don't have any answers. You know, they didn't find anything, and we were very lucky that we were able to bury something.
Yeah, most people didn't. You're right. It's a weird way to look at it, but most people didn't. So, okay. So 9/11 happens. I imagine the next couple months for you at 9 years old is a whirlwind. You know, things don't go immediately south for you in your personal life right then and there. But is there a tangible moment that you can look back on, even at 9, 10, 11 years old, where you become a different kid, where you're acting differently, where life is different beyond the obvious of not having your dad around?
Well, on 9/11 itself, the seeds were planted. When I got home from school that day, and it was, I think, honestly, one of the only times I saw it ever on television, I saw an image, a video of a person jumping from the building. Subconsciously, that was embedded in my brain. In the next few years, I stumbled upon these books that my mom purchased that showed timeline photos of the day, and the photos of people jumping were in them, and they were very prominent too.
Right.
So I was fixated on that, and I started at about 10, 11 years old. And you know, as I got older, obviously it grew, but I became obsessed with trying to then figure out what happened to him, because all I knew was what I was told, which was that they found him and that his death was quick. There was no other answers, and there was no other details as to what may have potentially happened. So for me, that could have been a few things. It could have been, you know, asphyxiation, you know, he died when the building collapsed, et cetera, or that maybe he jumped. And when that obsession started to grow, that's when I definitely can look back now and see, first of all, my addiction and my addictive traits, but also the change that I started to show as a person too.
Were you ever able to get closure on that issue? Did you find out the manner in which your dad passed?
Years later, after I was kind of fed lies, which I'll get into all of that obviously, but I was fed lies about what potentially happened to him. And yes, years later, I was able to have that closure and know exactly what happened, that he was in the staircase, and which is why they found him so quickly, and that he died probably when the building collapsed, but it was told to us that he got hit in the head with something probably, and he was alive one moment and gone the next.
It's a weird question to ask. Were you, like, emotionally, did you want to think that he had jumped, or are you glad that he didn't? Like, what were you looking for in trying to find out that answer?
To this day, I sort of still contemplate what I was looking for. I think, in a way, I wanted him to have jumped so that I could have tried to find him, because that's what I was determined to do. Okay. I wanted to find him in one of those photos and in some strange way, be there for his final moments. If he were to have done that, I would have not looked at him any differently. I already know how, from what I've read and seen, how severe it must have been inside that tower. And it doesn't, to me, take away from any person's, in my opinion, faith or what they believe in. You know, they were forced out of that building.
Sure.
They willingly choose to do that.
Sure.
But I think it highlights the severity of what was going on inside that tower. And for whatever reason, it really did fascinate me. And I'm not really a morbid person, but those sort of traits were certainly being portrayed as I was getting older, because I would talk about death a lot.
Did you ever contemplate taking your own life?
In addiction, I tried a couple times, but obviously I wasn't successful, but I was very lost. You know, I think now I'm in a really good place mentally right now.
Yeah.
But when I was 12, 13 years old, and then as when I went through my sexual abuse situation, I was definitely dealing with depression, certainly anxiety. I am an anxious person to this day, but my mental health was certainly prevalent, definitely in those early years.
You know, addiction, for a lot of people become addicted to drugs, alcohol, and in my case, gambling. Because it gives them relief from, some type of painful event. It lets a lot of us kind of live in a cocoon where we feel better, right? We can avoid the demons that come up from sexual abuse, from, other life situations that we don't know how, to process or handle. I did it. I was sexually abused as a kid. I don't talk about it much at all. It came out, in the sentencing phase of my trial. It's a part of who I am. It's a part of, why I am the way I am in a lot of regards. It's a part of the reason why gambling became so powerful for me, because it gave me the safe cocoon where I felt protected from my demons. You went down that road with drugs and gambling, and we're going to get into that part of your story here in a moment on Hello, My Name is Craig.
Back to more of Hello, My Name is Craig on The Fan with your host, Craig Carton, and supported by the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey, 800-GAMBLER.
Welcome back to Hello, My Name is Craig. Craig Carton with Matthew Bocci, who's the son of a man who unfortunately lost his life on 9/11, and then the ensuing years got really bad for Matt, and he was brave enough to tell his story and wrote a book. The name of the book is Sway, and you can get it on Amazon or wherever else you get your books. So without, I don't want to, just jump forward too far, Matt, but when we went into the break, they were talking about how, we're both addicts, and we kind of used, substances and or gambling to hide from our realities. In addition to losing your dad in fourth grade, you also were sexually abused by an uncle, who's a very popular guy in the family. And on multiple occasions, he sexually abused you. So you had a lot of things going on that I imagine you wanted to escape and hide from. How old were you when you first turned to drugs for that escape?
I picked up my first drink when I was 14 years old. And I'd be lying to you if I told you that that first drink was that moment I had been searching for my whole life, because it wasn't. I was very short, and I probably weighed 110 pounds soaking wet. I got very drunk, and I was throwing up, and I was like, "That's I'm not going to do this ever again." I started smoking weed recreationally in high school, but again, wasn't addicted to any of it.
Right.
I was very diligent with my schoolwork. I was a good student. I did have big aspirations. I still do have big aspirations for myself, but I envisioned my life to be something big as a kid in high school. And drugs and alcohol didn't grip me the way they did until my later years, my later adolescent years, but when I got into college, when I started dabbling with painkillers, it started with Adderall and other sorts of pills, but the prescription pills is where everything took off for me. And everything went downhill very quickly too.
Did you get what I'm talking about? Did you feel some sense of mental, emotional relief? You're the kid, you're a 9/11 kid, for lack of a better term. There's a decent number of people who know what that's like, but a lot of people don't. So you did immediately feel, once you found whatever it was for you, whether it was, pharmaceutical drugs, oxy, whatever it may be, you did immediately discover, wow, this makes me feel pretty good, yeah?
It made me feel good, and it shut off my brain, right? It shut off all the thoughts that seemed to corrode me at any given moment, really. No longer was I the child of 9/11. No longer was I the victim of sexual abuse. I was just able to feel normal, so to speak. And the pain was numbed. And so once that pain was numbed and all emotions and feelings were shut off for me, I was determined and keen to chase that specific type of high. Not even the high from drugs, but just the fact that I can feel shut off and at peace and serene and not have to worry about any of the other things that I went through in the past. And the fact that I've always felt labeled and judged. So yeah, that relief was certainly present. And it was something that I didn't want to let go of.
And at the height of it, how bad was the addiction?
Well, I can go into the nitty gritty. I was addicted to opiates, benzodiazepines, cocaine, weed, and I washed it all down with alcohol. At one point in my addiction at the height, I was supplementing between multiple types of opiates, but up to 900 milligrams of Oxy a day, 20 milligrams of Xanax a day, and at times an 8-ball of Coke. I don't say that to try to brag or anything like that.
No, sure.
And that was over the span of four and a half years or so. Things escalated very quickly for me.
So your family had to notice that there was something wrong, right? Your family was in tune with you. You have a loving family. You have younger brothers, your mom, a stepdad. At some point, I got to imagine someone said, Matt, what's going on, yeah?
2013, I was trying to get help. I had admitted to my mom that I was addicted to painkillers, and that was not even at the worst moment of it all. I went through my first detox in March 2013. Quickly relapsed when I got out, went back to college, again, another stint in the summer. And then in the next 2 years, I was ripping and running. And everyone noticed. And I had legal trouble then. And everyone was pretty aware. It's just I wasn't willing and able. Well, I was able, but I wasn't willing to stop. I wasn't willing to surrender.
Did you have a death wish?
I think in some ways I did, yeah. I was at a point in my life where I was okay if I didn't wake up the next morning.
Got it. At any of these moments in time, I just wonder, you talk in the book at one point where, when you were much younger, right after 9/11, where you thought you saw your dad or an image of your dad in the backyard when you were mm-hmm. messing around in the leaves and whatnot. And I wonder, over the course of the 3 or 4 years that you were spiraling out of control, did you ever have a conversation with your dad, or did you ever feel like you saw him or had any type of tangible closure with your dad? Did that ever take place?
Not until my defining moment where I decided to get sober, but I had many foxhole prayers to my dad. I was in and out of different hoods and different, cities and surrounding myself with people I should not have been hanging out with. And I really had no regard for my own life. And I think I was like an adrenaline junkie too. Like I chased the high of going to places I didn't belong. The fact that danger was imminent, it didn't matter to me. I enjoyed that feeling. And I had many run-ins with the police. And then in those moments, yeah, of course I was, Dad, please get me out of this. I'll stop. I promise I'll stop. Of course I didn't,
Right. I know there's one point when you got arrested, you had like 50 Oxy pills on you, and you called your uncle up to try to help you out. So, you were doing things, you were getting a lot of attention. I'm not sure if you wanted the attention, but you were doing things like you had to know, I'm going to get caught doing this, right? Like, as much as you were hiding the addiction for as long as you could, there's also a part of it, and I feel the same way about me for gambling, where, I was a liar. I was hiding things. I wasn't honest with people. Whatever it took to allow me to gamble more. But at the same time, I was doing things that you know someone's going to find out you're doing it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I had this immaculate web of lies that was spread among so many people. And I'd have to keep up with each, group of lies to each person that I told, mainly my mom. And I had all these different cons that I was pulling off, fake bank statements, fake receipts and invoices, all this stuff. And I knew at one point in time it was going to come crashing and burning. And it did, obviously. But it became very difficult at times to keep up with it all. And as everyone is watching on the outside, right, watching this downfall that I'm certainly in the midst of, I'm still thinking that I'm keeping it together. well enough that people are believing that I'm okay, you know?
Yeah, no, trust me. I know that part of the story all too well, man. It's, you know, you can, you're the capacity for dishonesty is amazing. And we're going to get to the fact that you're sober now, but I guarantee, I know the words you're going to say, the amount of open mental space you have now compared to, you know, when you were chasing and lying and trying to, where's the money coming from? Who am I going to for the next pill and all that stuff? Is people don't get it. It's like, it's almost like our brains are on a perpetual vacation now that we're not trying to figure out how to, you know, cover our next lie. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
It's crazy. So how do you did mention that gambling was a part of it. You know, obviously not the biggest part, but how did gambling rear its ugly head for you?
Well, this is a sneak preview for just discussions I'm having with some agents and publishers about a second book. But I'm almost 6 years sober. I haven't had a drink or drug in almost 6 years. And when I was in college, I was interacting with some people who were bookies and whatever. And I was getting an understanding of how spreads worked and all that type of stuff. Didn't get into it. I didn't have the money. I couldn't even keep up with drug addiction. There was no way I could deal with gambling. So when I was about 3 years sober, I'd have to fact check the timeline on this, but my first bet in sobriety was the Patriots Falcons game, Super Bowl.
Got it.
And I bet the Patriots money line. And so obviously such an exhilarating game. When they came back and won, I was like, holy crap, this is amazing.
So for 3 hours you're cursing the TV, and for the last 15 minutes you're the happiest guy on the planet.
Exactly. Just filled with joy. So in the next couple of years, I had some really high moments, of course, as probably every gambler does, right?
Yep.
But it always came crashing and burning, as it always does. And I got to a really harsh realization. It was actually the day that Kobe Bryant died, where I said, wow, life is so short, and I can't be going around spreading a message of hope, talking about my story of resilience and inspiration with all the other things that I went through. And meanwhile, I'm gambling in the darkness, right? And I'm hiding this big secret from everyone. And I knew it was a problem. It also progressed the same way drugs and alcohol did for me. But I had so many moments of big wins and et cetera that I also dissuaded myself. I was like, well, listen, like you're doing well. Why are you going to stop, right? You never walk away from that table with the, you know, full hand of chips. So I never did. And I had to come to that realization on my own. Actually, you know, it's been about a year and a half since I've gambled.
Good.
I knew that I can't engage. I can't obviously pick up a drink or a drug, right? All I have is today. But I also knew I couldn't be engaging in sketchy behaviors and trying to fill the void in other ways, right? And that's what it comes down to ultimately for me, is I have to live a clean and sober life in all regards. And mm-hmm. It can't just be around drinking and drugging.
What was the, talking to Matthew Bochy, who wrote a book called Sway, it's about his life, having found out, you know, having lost his dad on 9/11, and then the kind of really ugly rabbit hole his life went down. Glad to say he came out the other side of it, and he's alive and well, and able to join us today. Just to wrap up the drug part of your story, what was the pivotal moment? What was the epiphany? Walk us through the day that you woke up and said, I'm done. I can't do more drugs, and you came clean about everything. What was that day like? And why did that day happen?
Well, I was arrested and facing 3 felony charges. I was 23 years old. I had obviously a long life ahead of me. But in that moment, it seemed to be coming to an end. I knew that if I failed the drug test once I was put on probation, there was a really good possibility I was going to go to jail. And there was no way around that. No matter how good my lawyer was, the charges were clear as day. I was able to get, thankfully, some of the charges were reduced, but I still had to be sober. I couldn't stop. So on the morning of July 22nd, 2015, I had a meeting with my probation officer. It was the first meeting that I had. And I was told by my lawyer that if I were to pass that first drug test, realistically, I would not be called up for another 6 to 8 months or something like that. I only had a year probation. And at that point in time, I was on probation already for 2 months. So I purchased this detox mouthwash and two bags of fake urine because, you know, like any other addict, right? Why would I stop if I can get around the test some way? So this detox mouthwash would then provide me with about 45 minutes of clean saliva, and it tasted awful. And you put it in your, you put it in your mouth, swiggle it around, and then swallow it. And so I go into this drug test that morning, and I meet with my probation officer, and I'm looking at my watch as the time is slowly but surely diminishing, and I'm realizing if I don't get in there and she does this mouth swab test soon enough, I'm screwed. So I'm sitting across from her desk. On her keyboard is the mouth swab test in the little packaging, and she's having me sign all these forms, and she says to me, if you don't pass this drug test, we can call DIFUS because one of your brothers is under 18, et cetera, et cetera. And she looks me right in the eyes and she asks, are you going to pass the drug test?
And of course you said, of course I'm going to pass it.
I said, yeah. Right. Like I'm good.
Right. Cause you got the detox mouthwash in, and you're figuring if she gives me that test in the next 5 minutes and the product works, I'm good to go.
And I realized to myself in that moment, I'm like, wow, I thought this is going to be the best con that I've ever and may ever pull off. And I'm high as a kite. And so she's looking at me again, and she says it one more time. Are you sure you're going to pass? And I said, yes. She's like, okay. And she goes to bend down, and she grabs a cup, and she says, go pee in the cup. And I didn't bring my fake pee with me, of course. So I go into the bathroom. They have an angled mirror so that the guy who goes in there with you makes sure you're not using anything to mess with the test and use a fake, whatever. So he doesn't look. And I'm sitting there.
So in your mind, you're saying, if I had my fake urine with me, I could have pulled it off. The guy's not looking. Yep. I didn't bring it. Now you know you're screwed. If you fail the test, which you're going to, now you got a real problem on your hands. So you go back into the room, you meet the probation officer, and what? You tell her, or does she tell you you failed, or do you say, ma'am, I know I'm going to fail the urine test?
No, I already failed it. And I said, listen, she's like, I don't know. She's like, you've had about 2 months notice of this test. And she's like, when's the last time you got high? And I was like, about 4 days ago. And she's like, okay, when's the last time you actually got high? I was like, this morning.
Right.
And then she said, listen, I don't know if this is a cry for help or you genuinely can't stop. And I like cut her off. And I was like, no, I really do want to stop. I really do. And she's like, okay, I'll give you one last shot. And if you come back in a month and you're clean, I'll drop your charges. But if not, you're going to go to jail. And I said, okay.
And that was it.
Yeah, I went home that day, and I was by myself. And this is mainly one of the reasons I didn't consider myself an alcoholic, was because I didn't drink excessively every single day. I didn't drink during the day either. I also consumed massive amounts of narcotics, but that's besides the point. And I made myself a drink. I rolled myself a joint, and I went to go smoke it outside. And when I walked outside, I got hit by that, once again, beautiful blue sky day.
Hold on one sec. We'll take one final break, and then we'll wrap it up here. Kim Jones is coming up next on The Fan. Appreciate her patience here as well. It's Matthew Bocci. The name of the book is Sway. We'll continue one more segment right after this on The Fan.
Back to more of Hello, My Name is Craig on The Fan with your host, Craig Carton, and supported by the Council on Compulsive Gambling of New Jersey, 800-GAMBLER.
Welcome back to Hello, My Name is Craig. Matthew Bocci joins us. The name of his book is Sway. It's a fascinating life from the moment he found out that he lost his dad on 9/11. As we wrap up Mental Health Awareness Month of May, on the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, you go home, you got the joint rolled, you got the bourbon in the glass, you walk outside, and the day reminds you of Tuesday morning, September 11th, 2001, the day you lost your dad, and what happened?
I started crying. And for me to cry in active addiction was a rarity, to say the least. So in that moment, I say, Dad, please give me a sign. I need help. On September 12th, 2001, my mom was told to look for the signs. You know, it was pretty clear that my dad wasn't coming home. That night, a fly landed on her nightstand, and that was her indication that my dad wasn't coming home. And that fly would be our sign of my dad, and it was a symbol of my dad, and would be around in the next 15-plus years. At that point, it was 15-plus years. And so in that moment, in July 2015, I'm crying. I said, Dad, please give me a sign. I need help. and this fly lands on the deck railing that I'm leaning against. And it's literally about 5 inches away from my arm. And it's just moving around in a circle and stopping and looking at me. And again, moving around in a circle and stopping and looking at me. And I pulled out my phone and I recorded it. And I said, you know what? Enough's enough. And I said, this is it. I'm going to get help. I walked inside and I called up a detox facility and I said, listen, I'm not sober right now. I need a bed tonight. And they said, we can't get you in tonight. We can get you in Friday. I said, okay, fine. Book it. I want that bed. And I had obviously the legal stuff that I told you about, but then I also had all these other things that I had done. I had this credit card scheme that I was pulling. My mom was dealing with all this fraud stuff. I had used her cards fraudulently, and I sent her this long message and admitted to everything. And I said, I'm going to get help on Friday. I'm going to detox. And I've been sober since then. It's not been an easy road, obviously, but I went to that detox for a week, and then I went to a rehab stay for another 28 days. And then ultimately I went to a sober facility for a sober house for about a year. And that's when I actually ended up coming forward about the sexual abuse that happened to me as a kid and started to heal.
How did your family react to your revelation about your uncle?
Well, it was certainly a surprise, you know, because I put on this facade that everything was okay. I told myself I would never tell a soul about it. Apparently I did tell one or two people when I was under the influence, but I don't remember it. I said to myself, there's no way I can repeat this to anyone, and I wouldn't. And so from that point on, I was okay. I was around him a lot, and people would never suspect that anything happened because I wouldn't allow them to come to that realization or that assumption. So he always had this creepy vibe about him, but it was never, I don't think anyone ever suspected he would do something the way he did. And we didn't get into all the nitty gritty and the details, right. But what ended up leading to it was him telling me after he had been grooming me and whatnot, he told me my father jumped. He knew that's what I was looking for. And in that moment of him telling me that, that's when it started. And so for me, I'm looking for a father figure. I'm looking for someone to talk to me about my dad and talk to me about what happened that day, because no one wanted to engage in those conversations anymore. It was too powerful for them. It was too emotional. And for a 14-year-old kid to be looking at people jumping from the North Tower or the World Trade Center, it was a lot for them to want to discuss that.
So your uncle used your dad's death on 9/11 to groom you for sexual abuse. Ugh.
Correct. And so I came forward. I told my Uncle Tony, who's I'm very close to this day. At times I look at him as an older brother. I called him, and I was supposed to meet with him for lunch that day. And I was home making amends to family. And I was supposed to leave to go back to New Hampshire to my sober living facility. And I call him and I said, listen, I got to tell you something. And I tell him, when I was 14 years old, I was sexually abused. And I go into the details about who did it and what happened. And he said to me, I am in Englewood, New Jersey right now, which is the last place I was with your dad before he died. And he's like, I'm going to meet you at your house. And this is his sign to me that we're going to do something about this. And, I told him that I was willing and able, and I wanted to seek justice and pursue legal action. And I did. And it was very difficult, you know, to have to tell my whole family about what happened. And they were devastated, you know, because they all knew about the drugs. They all knew about my obsession with my dad. They didn't know about this secret that I've been holding on to for nearly 10 years. And no one knew, really. And so it was hard to relive it all and to talk about it. But I have seen the most healing in my life by being open and vulnerable and getting it off my chest, because I know by doing so, I can maybe inspire and help someone else who's going through something.
Yeah, it's
similar.
Really brave. It's really brave. It's so brave and courageous. You know, I've one of my biggest life's regret is not coming forward, not being strong enough to tell the story. And to this day, I really haven't ever gotten into it. And no one needs to know the nitty gritty of it. That's just salacious. People don't need to know, you know, the exact acts that took place. It's the fact that, you know, you were sexually abused and I was sexually abused. And it's one of my biggest regrets as an adult. you know, that I haven't been able to, you know, really get into it and have that conversation, because you could help so many people by being open. And I agree with you. Like, even writing your book, I'm sure, was cathartic for you. But living your life honestly and just being open with your the people who love you the most, because those are the people you hurt the most, it's just amazing that you have the strength and courage to do it. And you should know that it's awesome that you do it. Like, I've never met you before in my life, but, you know, I'm proud of you for doing it, because we need more people to come forward and be honest and tell their stories and admit to their frailties, too. It's okay to be an addict. It's okay to admit that you're an addict. And it's even better when you're able to admit it and you can ask somebody for help. You know, I've said many times on the show that picking up the phone saved my life. You know, I didn't have a death wish per se, but, you know, I had a moment in time where, you know, if I didn't wake up the next morning, it was going to be all right. You know, and I picked up the phone and a friend saved my life. So I get that part of it. Before I let you go, Matt, do you believe that your dad saved your life? That moment of clarity when you saw the fly, that, you know, your uncle happened to be in Englewood at that moment, a place he was with your dad a lot, that in a weird way, your dad did play a role in your sobriety and saving you?
Absolutely. I mean, he's been there every step of the way. I know you're familiar with 12-step programs. I consider my dad, and I use my dad as my higher power. And for me, prayer and meditation are a big part of my life. But sometimes with prayer, I speak to my dad, my higher power, as if he's sitting right here with us, you know, just talking. And it's been very, very consoling for me, and it allows me to put things into perspective. But, you know, one thing, I've used my dad's death now for the better, right? I've used the fact that he was unhappy, and he wanted to find his true passion. And instead for me, instead of working in finance and thinking that by doing that I'm keeping his legacy alive, I'm pursuing my passion. I'm pursuing what makes me feel fulfilled and what I know is helping other people. And so that's what I'm doing today. And I think he'd be very proud of that.
I think your mom's probably pretty proud of you too.
She is. She is. Definitely.
Yeah. And like I said, I'm proud of you also, and I've never met you. But the name of the book is Sway. It's Matthew Bocci. There may be a second book coming up as well. Real quick, how are your brothers doing? The rest of your family, everybody's in a good place now, 20 years later?
Everyone is good. We are all healthy and happy, and, yeah, everyone's living good lives.
Well, listen, I appreciate you sharing your story. I really do. And I'm glad you had time to join us this morning. Enjoy the rest of the Memorial Day weekend. Best to your family. I look forward to meeting you one day as well. And if you write that second book, by all means, give us a call, because I'd love to have you back on. And I suggest everybody, whether you have a connection to 9/11 or not, it's a real life story. It's called Sway. You can get it on Amazon and all the other book outlets you go to. His name is Matthew Bocci, and he's a survivor. And he's alive today to tell his story, and I'm glad that he is. Matt, thanks so much for joining us, pal. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Craig. Have a Memorial Day.